You've been so brainwashed into thinking that you get all of your nutrient from whole foods, which is where it needs to start from, absolutely, and that there's no place and no scientific study that shows the benefits of certain micronutrients. I'm sorry, Dave, this is something that we've got to correct.
Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Let's talk about what you know about which specific genes make you prone to exaggerated inflammatory viral responses and lower respiratory problems. Because you guys actually know this at the DNA company. You are, in fact, you and I had a conversation about this long before COVID existed. Share with our listeners, what are the genes that if they have access to their genetic data, they might want to look at? Because if you're one of those people, isolation and maybe even doing some stuff preventatively would be good. So what are the genes?
Indeed. So the first things first is let's just repeat and reemphasize. Ultimately, the real, you know, knockout punch is coming from something called cytokine storms, which is just a sexy word of saying a deregulated, hyped up, amped up inflammatory response. Okay? So ultimately, if you know yourself to be that individual that has those exaggerated inflammatory responses just in general, if you know that you're that individual that when the common cold and or flu, forget SARS-CoV-2 for the time being, comes around, you tend to spiral into a more pneumonia-like presentation and so on and so forth. If you are the individual that your innate anti-inflammatory response is muted, in other words, your innate inflammatory response is exaggerated more than often, more than not, this is a risk category. And it is for that response we can look at genetic phenomena. And at the top of that genetic response, or the genes that control your anti-inflammatory capacity, is your methylation capacity overall. And that's not just MTHFR. And you threw that one at me at the very start and you had me laughing before we even started this podcast, Dave. Please, come on, the Dave Asprey followers by now know MTHFR does not equal methylation or vice versa. Okay, so it's a remarkable cascade, starting with actually more important than MTHFR is the SHMT1, serine hydroxymethyltransferase gene, far more important actually than MTHFR.
Explain what that is. And there are some people who are new listeners who probably don't even know MTHFR. And so don't be feeling like you're left out of the cool kids club if you don't know about this. These are just the very common things that people have. And a lot of people were saying, I don't know why stuff that I think should help doesn't help. And they kind of get stuck on either recovering or hacking their health. MTHFR is just the lowest hanging fruit. So define it real quick and then define SHTM1. I don't even know much about that one.
So perfect. So methylation is this one of the most brilliant, if not most beautiful examples of what we call cellular cascades. Methylation is the process by which when your cells absorb a number of nutrients, but at the top of it, B12 and B9, those beautiful micronutrients in the B-complex family, together with B6 and the other B-complexes, when your cells absorb B12 and B9, your cells do something. They take these two micronutrients on a cycle. And methylation is the thing that does that. And to do that thing, which we won't get into the weeds here, there are several genes that must act in a perfectly timed orchestra. So think of it this way. Think of a five-person relay race, all of the listeners out there. And the job of this relay race, obviously, is to finish the race. And you're passing a baton, first runner to second runner. Second runner grabs the baton, passes it to third. If the first runner at any point in time decides, you know what, I'm the fastest, I'm just going to run and not going to pass on the baton, you're disqualified. Methylation is a cyclical process that requires one gene, then another, then another, then another to do its job in a perfectly timed cascade. The first of these genes are SHMT1, serine hydroxymethyltransferase. It begins to biotransform your folate when your B9, folate, green leafy vegetables, when the folate gets into the cells, SHMT1 biotransforms that folate, getting it prepared for MTHFR, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, which further biotransforms your B9 into something called 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, 5-MTHF. Now that B9 has the baton. And what is the baton here? A methyl group. a little CH3 methyl group. Now, these CH3 methyl groups are super duper active. There are certain groups, there are certain moieties, oxidants, nitrous groups, sulfuric groups, methyl groups, that when you take a methyl group, CH3, and you bind it to something, to a substrate, the behavior of that thing that you've now bound CH3 to changes. When you bind CH3 to your estrogens, they behave differently. They're no longer estrogenizable. When you bind CH3 to dopamine and to noradrenaline, they're no longer neurologically active, and so on and so forth. Importantly, when you bind CH3 to your DNA, the way your genes are expressed changes. So the body is going to do everything to control this this all-important reaction known as methylation. And it goes SHMT1, MTHFR, MTRR, MTR. Coming in on the side, you've got fucosyl transferase, you've got TCN2, transcobalamin. Without getting into the weeds, it's this beautiful cascade, beautiful cascade. Okay.
And by the way, guys, that was without the weeds. And a lot of people are going, what? But here's the thing. It's okay to reach out for help biohacking, which is one of the reasons that I called you and I did my DNA company results. And we spent 2 hours going through my results and you're explaining stuff. Cause I honestly don't know those pathways without looking at them on a sheet of paper, but you did find things, a couple different alleles that are tied to that exaggerated inflammatory response. If people have those, it's not that they're more likely to get the virus. It's that they're more likely to get a huge inflammatory cascade and end up in the hospital unless they block it. What are the genes that people should watch out for?
I would say at the top of the list is the SHMT1, certainly the MTHFR, but then
but that's not one gene, either one of those. So what are the alleles they should be looking at?
So in the SHMT1 gene, one of the most functional, so if you have access to your data, 23andMe or otherwise, DNA company, look up the addresses that we look for genes. The SHMT1 address that you want to look up is the RS1979277, and forgive me, that's the way my weird brain works. So the RS1979277 is the SHMT1 SNP. You want to ensure, I mean, not that you have any choice in the matter, but the A version, the alpha apple version allele of the RS1979277 SHMT1 gene is the version that is suboptimal. These are the individuals that tend to have hyperinflammatory reactions.
What percentage of people are we talking about?
About 15% of the general population, slightly higher in, if I'm not mistaken, don't quote me on this, but slightly higher in the Eastern European population. But generally speaking, about 15% of the human population can carry 1A. That's 15% carrying 1A. Less than that, so we estimate that less than 10% carries 2As. If you carry 2As on your SHMT1, your anti-inflammatory potential is significantly below average. Dave, very quickly, those are the people when they get things like Lyme disease, for example, Dave.
Yeah, like me.
Thankfully you're a double G, so by God's
good
grace.
Deal. But Lyme disease kicked my ass. Actually, it was more toxic mold that causes Lyme, but that's another discussion.
Yeah, that's a different one. But if you're a double A SHMT1, you get Lyme, neuroborreliosis, you don't do very well unless you really get that bugger out of the body. Just FYI.
So for that population, I love looking at these risk populations because guess what, guys? They're the perfect guinea pigs. Because if something works to restore a proper inflammatory response in the people who are weakest, and you do the same thing, you're probably going to get a robust response. If what you're doing is herbal or pharmaceutical or even lifestyle, it's not a guarantee. But it's likely unless you're dealing with specific epigenetic switches for those things, which are an on-off situation. That's not what I'm talking about.
Nicely said.
So for that population and thus for the rest of us, are there specific things that work? I have some things I want to run past you, but I want your thoughts before I pollute them with mine.
Well, the first thing is it's more for what, well, there's both. There's a double side here. There is what you don't do and then what you do. So the people that are the SHMT1 for that SNP that we spoke of, if you carry the A, and definitely if you carry the double A allele, what we and many others are starting to see is that you don't respond well to methylfolate. In fact, you've got to be very careful taking too much methyl B9. Rather, you respond way better, all things equal, to formal folate, which is otherwise known as folinic acid. And I have no clue why that is considered a pharmaceutic here in Canada. It's a prescription. Folinic acid, which is just a version of folate, is considered a prescription drug here, and it's sold at ridiculously elevated
prices. And that's
prices.
The same as 5-MTHFR, 5-methohydroxyfolate.
Now that's the methyl 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. This is 5-formyl tetrahydrofolate.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. I actually thought folinic acid was another name for it, and you're saying there's a difference. This is interesting. Okay. Thank you for that. Big difference.
So the synonyms for the methyl, where we have methyl folate, 5-methyl folate, 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, 5-5-M. Those are all of those. Quite in distinction to that is the formyl folate. That's the folinic acid. These AAs tend to respond far better. So in other words, Dave, because this is talked about so much in the autistic population, and you've got that subgroup of autistic children, you give them the 5-methylfolate that many other parents say this was a godsend, but the 5-methylfolate just seems to, for some children, it increases their irritability, it increases some of their phenotypic responses. Oftentimes they're the AAs, and you get a much better response when you give them the folinic acid, which is the formyl folate in distinction to the methylfolate.
Okay. That is okay. So, but you're not saying everyone should take folinic acid. Okay. So what are the things that are likely to reduce the inflammatory risk in everyone, including that population?
So, figuring out where you are, by the way, per what we just said, and by the way, per extension, and again, I just forgive me here, Dave, equivalently, you have the B12 story, because if you did not know your B12, the MTR and MTRR versions of those genes, you might just be taking methyl B12, thinking it's the best version, and it certainly is the best for most people, but adenosyl B12 can be a better option for some individuals, depending on their MTR, MTRR. So the first thing here is figuring where you are on that scale, figuring which of these versions boost and optimize your methylation. Optimizing your methylation function, all things equal, is one of the best things you can do for health. And Dave, you've just nailed this in the past. So optimizing methylation cellular function, start there. Now, inflammation doesn't begin and end with methylation.
I got to pause for a second there. So a lot of people listening have ordered your DNA test. They have their DNA from sometime in the last 10 years. They've had it done. But there's a much larger number of people listening who haven't done that. They're not going to know their MTHFR status, and they're looking around going, I got to order some supplements or not. So let's assume that they don't have access to their genetic information. Maybe they're encouraged to get it now. But if you didn't know and you're saying, I'm worried, maybe I think I might be one of those high risk populations because, my grandmother got pneumonia or something, or maybe you've had it. What would you do to make sure that inflammatory thing doesn't hit you?
So here we go. At the top of it, again, please, for the listeners, I'm not a medical doctor making a prescription, but we're talking about just the healthy native things we can use. NAC, number one.
I love it. That's on my list. All right. Well, let's get your entire list, then I'm going to look for things missing. Doses, how much?
We typically look at NAC 250 milligrams as a base dose, which you can take twice a day, three times a day. It's very safe, up to 500, 600, 700, 800 milligrams. We like to start with 250 milligrams. And here's a little biohack. NAC's 250 milligrams can be accentuated in terms of its overall function when combined with an equal amount of ascorbic acid vitamin C. So 250 NAC, 250 vitamin C.
That's it for vitamin C is 250?
No, I'm saying as a combined dose, okay, of which you can then double down on that as needed.
Okay, so how much vitamin C would you take irrespective of NAC?
You know, me personally, because of, mind you, all my other eating habits and looking at where I'm getting vitamin C from, I personally don't go above 500 milligrams unless I am in dire straits, me personally.
Okay.
Okay. And by that, I mean, you know, as a healthy dose, because mind you, I'm eating foods that are rich. I'm eating my bell peppers. I'm eating other foods for which I know I'm getting a good amount of vitamin C from, just in any event.
Okay. Got it. So when it comes to vitamin C, I normally do about a gram in a day, you know, 500 milligrams twice or a gram once.
Perfectly fine.
But now at this time, I'm doing like, 4 to 6 grams.
And just so that you know, some of the best studies of intensive care unit interventions, IV vitamin C has been quite successfully used at the levels that you're talking about, Dave, to majorly quiesce a cytokine storm. So again, what we're trying to do here and what I'm doing and what you're correcting me on is we've got to look at where we are. Are we prophylactic? Are we showing symptoms, or are we then dealing with...
Okay, I'm thinking more prophylactic, but if you're showing symptoms, let's go through these in both of those. This is going to be really helpful for people. I've studied this stuff for 20 years around controlling my own body's crazy out of control inflammatory responses. So I feel like I've got like whack-a-mole, like no one's business on cytokines, but, I really want to pick your brains. Okay. So I'm going to ask you all these things for prophylactic use. Okay. Now I'm concerned I'm in a high risk situation, but I don't actually have it. I don't have symptoms of it anyway. Okay. So NAC 250 a couple times a day, vitamin C 250 a couple times a day. And that's probably it. Okay, and then what else?
So typically, those two things typically combined. I would ensure that I'm getting my vitamin D levels. Again, we have to know where we are geographically and so on and so forth. But I would be shooting in these times for at least 2,000 IUs daily. And that's if a D3. Okay, and again, you all know yourselves. You all know if you're taking higher than that just to naturally to keep your levels up. I'm speaking here without the knowledge of where you are. But generally speaking, we're not talking 500 IUs here for the vast majority of individuals. Okay, so just getting that vitamin D up. I would also ensure that you're balancing your methylation. What does that mean? It means that you're taking the appropriate B9, the appropriate B12, whether you're getting it dietarily or not. And then you're making sure, but because B6 is, and the rest of the Bs, the helper Bs. So in other words, a basic good basal B100, B50 type baseline important here to ensure that methylation cycle during these periods at least are operating at an optimal level. Now, next. One of the first micronutrients that is depleted during a viral infection, we have no reason to believe not SARS-CoV-2 as well, is selenium. Selenium is a cofactor to the GPX enzyme, the glutathione peroxidase enzyme, which is radically important when combined with SOD2. SOD2, superoxide dismutase 2, combined with GPX, are the two enzymes that control your redox homeostasis. Let's pause there very quickly, Dave. So that redox is how your cells are handling your oxidants. You want a certain level of oxidants in your cells, by the way. You just don't want too much of it. The homeostasis of not having too little, not having too much is super duper important, and it's called the redox homeostasis. Here's a very, very important point, Dave. Viral infections, and it seems including SARS, if we can judge by the original SARS of 18 years ago, what does it do? Viral infections typically increase oxidants in your cells. There is typically increased oxidants in your cells upon viral infection. Here comes the real zinger. Increased oxidants increases viral replication. So we call this the viral loop. So a virus enters your cell. Your cells now start to accumulate oxidants. The accumulation of the oxidants tends to prefer and send the virus into replication, which is the very thing you don't want. So during viral replications, the ability to quiesce that increase in oxidation is going to be radically important. And the other thing that's happening is the viral replication is usurping. It's using up radically important micronutrients such as selenium. Selenium and NAC, these are things that we saw. NAC, vitamin C, what we've said before, selenium, I don't have, I'm going to be very careful. I'm not sure what the dose is. Please forgive me.
It's all right to look up an appropriate dose. Now, what about form? There's one group says sodium selenate. And there's another that's an older form that goes in very fast. And then there's another form that sticks around for a long time, which is methionine. It's a methionine group, but there's some weird thing on the front of it. I don't remember what it is. Anyway, that one. So the two seleniums, which one do you like? Yes.
Don't know.
Okay.
Have to be honest with you. Don't know.
I would say whichever one you can get is probably the right one at this point. And the people I know. Yeah.
The one that you mentioned is the one that I take, which of course my mind is now looping as to what that full name is.
Yeah. It's a very long, weird word. Given all the weird people that I know, biochemists, the people who are immersed in this, I actually think the sodium selenate is probably better, but it's easier to overdose on it. And it has a very short half-life in the body, but it probably gets used more effectively. That said, take what you can get and be careful on your dosing. All right. What about zinc?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Doses and forms that you like?
Please forgive me. The piconate, is it?
There's zinc picolinate.
Picolinate. All right. Yeah. And somewhere in the realm of about 15 milligrams. Again, everyone out there, get the form you can get. And obey or speak to someone that knows better, like the Daves. And, Dave, do you have some of these recommendations? But zinc is definitely up there.
I do make a copper zinc orotate. And orotate is interesting because it slots itself into the mitochondria in a different way than most forms. I also like zinc carnosine, but I don't make one.
There you go. So definitely the second. I did not know what you just said about the combination with the zinc and copper. I did not know that.
I just have copper and zinc together because they kind of balance each other out. If you have too much zinc, you tend to deplete copper and vice versa.
Very good point. Very good point.
And so I put those together as a stack. But the orotate or orotic acid form has really cool, interesting studies. It's mostly unknown. And my goal is to make stuff I can't already just buy because it's easier to buy it if someone else pays for the R&D.
Absolutely.
So selenium, zinc, D3, vitamin C, and NAC. Anything else you put in that stack?
Right now, I mean, these are what, to be honest with you, that's my stack. That's my stack.
I have a couple. Okay, so this is your prophylactic stack, all right? Someone just says, all right, I just started coughing. I'm getting tired. I can't taste anything. I'm pretty darn sure I'm coming down with something. What do you change or add to your stack?
Excellent question. So first and foremost, again, I really urge everyone to understand I'm not an acute interventionist, but I would then at that juncture, I would really start paying attention to getting up my vitamin C's to the levels that Dave was talking about. Probably don't do as much of the NAC as vitamin C. So in other words, you can top off NAC way sooner than you can top off vitamin C.
2 grams max, I would say, per day.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I would start doing that. One of the things about NAC is that it breaks the disulfide bond in the mucosal secretion. So in other words, simply saying, it's just a really good, it gets the mucus out of the system.
Mucolytic.
There we go. All right. So I would definitely be doing that. Dave and I, please forgive me here. Everyone, major disclaimer coming up. But I have just found this, and I've found others who found this as well. I have found that a puff of hydrogen peroxide and an inhaled puff of hydrogen peroxide, it has become part of my daily routine. And it is, in my opinion, and again, don't ask me for the science of it. I mean, obviously, we know hydrogen peroxide, and but I found it to be a gem of a gem of a gem. Prophylactically, I would do it once or so in the morning. If I see symptomatically, I would do it 5 times a day, 3 to 5 puffs.
You're doing, when you say puffs, you're using a spray bottle of 3% while inhaling?
There you go. Yeah. So it's sort of like,
Like some of you have sunscreen or bug spray or something. I'm like, oh, yeah.
That so just, spray. Just something that gets a nice vaporizable. In other words, something you can breathe in. And so you breathe out, and then on the breathe in, you go, got a couple of puffs in.
The guy who's probably most responsible for that work who's alive today is Frank Schallenberger, who's been on the show.
Beautiful.
And do you know Frank?
I don't.
Okay. He's one of the I'd call him the grandfathers of ozone therapy. And I've referenced his mitochondrial research very extensively in Headstrong. And he has an intravenous hydrogen peroxide protocol that's worked for tuberculosis and it's worked for a very long time. but you can use a nebulizer as well. And they're in short supply right now, but it's just a little plastic cup thing that makes kind of a mist when you run air through it. And you can also get ultrasonic ones. But what you do then is you put a few drops of hydrogen peroxide in the thing, and then it looks kind of like you're vaping, but you're vaping water vapor with hydrogen peroxide to get very deep in the lungs. I love it that you said that because as a preventative, every time you go out, you might as well do it because it's in the mouth. But if you are getting sick, man, I'm surprised and happy that you mentioned hydrogen peroxide.
Hugely beneficial. It's magic. Again, prophylactically, it's not something I do just every day, but a puff. But for symptomologically, if something is happening, I would get up to 5 puffs 5 times a day, and it's still very safe.
Got it. That is interesting. It may also stain your clothes. Watch out. If you're using 3% like that, you might have an interesting response. So also, if you've bled anywhere, it's really good after a murder scene. It just cleans things right up. I learned that on Dexter. It's not from personal experience. Actually, the truth of the matter is, when I lived in a house with toxic mold as a child, I had 10 nosebleeds a day. I'm not joking. It was just a constant thing. Just I'd walk around, blood would just spurt out of my nose. It was really good for dating. And I did figure out the hydrogen peroxide gets blood stains out really good because I was like, you know, just don't stand in the spatter zone around me and we're all good. So aside from that, I think it's great. What else do you do? You're starting to get sick.
That's my deck. Up to and including, and of course we can start getting, now we go into the pharmaceutics, now we're going to call someone. Please, by the way, everyone out there, if you are listening and if you feel you're going, you know, in terms of respiratory distress, first and foremost, if you know yourself, don't just be rushing off to your doctors or to the hospital. Please call ahead, speak to someone if you can, have someone that loves you speak to someone, because we've really got to be careful what we're doing. And that's just a disclaimer to say, listen, guys, we got to be responsible.
Okay. Thank you for saying that.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us, and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount. Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat Cold Tub. I have one in my backyard. That's Chili Goat Tubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
I did a whole podcast, a mini podcast, where I'm just like, hey guys, here's all the stuff I know about IL-6, the inflammatory cytokine that is the primary thing that's causing the cytokine storm. And there's more than 40 studies, I think, that I referenced, not that I necessarily put the asterisks, but I was citing them as I went through the podcast from memory and whatnot. And the one that stands out is something I always take when I fly, and it's called Andrographis, which is an herb that has multiple studies about respiratory infections and viruses, 20% lower duration and a similar reduction in the likelihood of getting it. So I like that. It also drops IL-6 directly in studies. I like that stuff because I don't want IL-6. It's oftentimes paired with echinacea. So I think that is really worth taking if you start getting symptoms, and probably if you might have been exposed.
Yeah. Dave, how do you play off the, and I, just because I don't know, and again, just having the opportunity for me to you and you to your audience, how do you play off of echinacea in the pre-symptom versus post-symptom? I hear certain things about when you take echinacea and then when you don't. Do you have a take on that?
They say you don't want to take it chronically, you know, so taking it for more than 6 or 8 weeks, both andrographics and echinacea, they tell you not to, because you need some IL-6. If you suppress IL-6 dramatically, and these are two of the, well, andrographis is one of the most potent ones, and there's a few other things. So I would say you want to pulse it. So if you went, you know, you went shopping and you licked the shopping cart, maybe you ought to take it for a few days, because if it's going to get you, it's going to get you then. And the second you have a little bit of a symptom, you can take it for a couple of days. Like last week, okay, we've been self-isolating pretty darn well. My daughter's like, Daddy, my throat is a little bit. I'm like, yeah, take some andrographis along with the other, you know, vitamins. I just did an Instagram post with all the vitamins I have my kids on right now. So she took it for 2 days. Like, I actually don't have a sore throat anymore. I'm like, all right, stop taking it. That's fine. Yeah. And clearly that was not the virus. Well, who knows? Maybe it was, but it's highly unlikely just given that where she get it. So I look at that stuff, and then I look at turmeric or curcumin.
Good. Excellent.
And there are studies on IL-6 on that. And the mistake people make there is they take it with black pepper extract, which increases inflammation because it pokes holes in your gut and lets lipopolysaccharides through. And there's studies about that. So look, black pepper is not required with turmeric. There's many other safer ways to get into the body. And the formula that I make doesn't have that. But what it does have is something called Boswellia, which also has studies for IL-6. And there's something called Stefania root, which is a hard to find Chinese medicine that just completely stops some of the cytokines besides IL-6. And maybe it's not completely stopping, but for me, as someone who's had toxic mold, who's had Lyme disease and had chronic inflammation for much of my life, if I take that stuff on a regular basis, Stefania root, Boswellia slash frankincense is another name for it. And I do that. I don't get the chronic inflammation. It takes care of the cytokine storm, and it's not even a storm. It just takes care of cytokines that are too high in me anyway. So I tell people, if you take high doses of that stuff and you're not sick, you know what you're going to do? You're going to suppress immunity.
Yeah, so important, that distinction, so important.
So prophylactically, I take a normal dose, and if I'm getting sick, I'm like, I crank that dose right on up. And it seems to be particularly important. I also, to your point, I will nebulize hydrogen peroxide. I'll also nebulize colloidal silver. There's good evidence about that. Or a few drops of Lugol's or nascent iodine in a 0.9% or basically 1% saline solution. The reason you want to nebulize a 1% saline is putting pure water mist without salt in it into the lungs in high doses can actually cause an opposite effect of what you're looking for. And it's actually really important. It's not that hard to make 1% saline solution. You can Google how to do it. You also don't want to use tap water. This is just for people listening. You know these things because you're a doctor. I get mine out of an IV bag because I'm lazy. And I have IV bags because I'm a dork. But for most of us, it's you boil the water first and then you add the salt and then you put it in a sterile container and it's all good to go for a while, especially if you add iodine. But those are the things I'd be looking at, as well as ozone therapy. I'm doing rectal ozone.
What's your take on allicin? Having a bit of,
It probably works. I'm a fan of garlic, and allicin comes from garlic. It's the active ingredient in garlic, just for people listening, and onions to a certain extent, the whole allium family. I don't think taking it on a regular basis is particularly good for you. Lots of people, I'm taking garlic because it's good for me. When I was a raw vegan, I did it all the time and all that, but it does have unusual effects, I think cognitively, especially at higher doses. So I say, if you're getting sick, yes. But where I go before allicin is I go to oregano leaf extract and oregano oil extract. They're different. And there are studies for viruses around OLE as well as olive leaf extract. And my particular favorite one that I think is also better than allicin is hydroxytyrosol, which is the primary antioxidant in olive oil. And you pull that stuff out, a capsule of hydroxytyrosol is, you know, 100 bottles of olive oil. It's kind of the resveratrol of olive oil if resveratrol comes from wine. And literally, I take this stuff every day, and I do that anyway. Just if I was getting sick, I'd be like, I'm doubling down. And I take that stuff every day because I used to weigh 300 pounds, because I had arthritis when I was 14, and you've seen my unusual genetics, and you know my health history because we've talked about it. So I'm not telling everyone to take this stuff. I'm just saying you should have a stack of things that stop IL-6, because if you're starting to go down this inflammatory cascade, you will know it because you'll feel like shit. You might want to turn those things up. And by the way, I'm not talking about COVID. I'm talking about any infection that you have. You might want to do this. Like this is how I don't get sick. Antibiotics every month for 15 years. I don't have to do that anymore because I learned those tricks.
And Dave, you know, it's worth mentioning that from the pharmaceutical perspective, again, this is not the prescription, but it's to highlight the point that Dave is making. The sort of off-label use drugs that now everyone is clamoring, everyone meaning the medical agencies and associations, to try to see if it works. They're all colchicine, anti-inflammatory, hydroxychloroquine. The drugs that we're testing for the COVID and to try to quiesce the cytokine storm, they're all at their core anti-inflammatory IL-6 modulators at the end of the day. So what Dave is saying here is so important. I do want to emphasize, Dave, forgive me, there is the difference between prophylactic and acute symptomology.
It's really important. And I haven't said that enough, probably. Okay, here's what I take, you know, regularly because I don't have it. If I'm sick, I radically ramp up vitamin C. So if you're saying I'm going to do the same thing when I'm sick as when I'm well, look, you probably don't work out when you're really sick. These are just different states of the body. So thank you. I've not been saying that enough. And I'm going to steal that from you in other shows and just remind people, because you're hitting something so critical.
It's homeostasis, right, Dave? At the end of the day, we're striving to be homeostatic as best as optimal homeostasis as much as we can.
Now, I'm about to do an Instagram rant. I've been recording some thoughts of things like this that I have, but I want to gut check it with you and share it with listeners here before it goes on Instagram. I look at this this idea that we can flatten the curve. So we say, okay, if everyone gets sick and goes to the hospital all at once, we'll run out of hospital space and it's going to be really bad and more people will die from lack of hospitals. So our best and brightest are saying, oh, you know what we're going to do? We're going to have the same number of people get sick and the same number of people go to the hospital, but because we space them out better, then less of them will die because we'll have more ventilators available. That's pretty much the flatten the curve strategy. And in order to buy the strategy, we'll just basically destroy our economy by 50% for at least 6 months and probably for several years. My take on this is that's stupid, because our goal should be not to flatten the curve. It should be to reduce the area under the curve, because that's the number of people who get sick. And if you want to talk about the number of people who are hospitalized, what if we could make it so everyone got sick, but only 1% of people were even hospitalized? Like that's the goal. It's area under the curve. Whether people get sick 3 months from now or they get sick this month isn't that important compared to whether if they get sick, they are just not that sick. And it seems like IL-6 modulation, the way we just talked about, oh, and statins will modulate IL-6 too. Like we can, come on, drug companies, you guys, there's money on the table for you. Come on, get more people on statins. You guys have to do that. Like, I don't care how we do it. But doesn't it feel like medically, genetically, there's some stuff we could do?
100%.
What are the things? What are we missing?
Let me just. I do, because it would be hypocritical of me not to say this. When I first started to play, you know, you talk about the herd immunity. I must say the emotive gut response is, oh my God, but we don't know what we're dealing with. We don't know how many people that if we try to do this, i.e., not just flatten the curve but reduce the area under the curve, what are we doing? How many people are going to end up dying from this and so on and so forth? So I must say, to not be hypocritical, I was very hesitant at the concept. However, when you start looking at if we let this thing go, if we just keep tagging on another 2 weeks of self-isolation, of we're going to try to jumpstart the economy. In other words, what I'm trying to say is not make a solution, but I am trying to raise awareness now as to there has to be other ways that we should approach this, because we're not looking at the ripple effect. Number one. Number two.
Poverty is a disease.
It lasts much longer than 2 weeks. Okay. So when you get to that realization, it is not to allow all of us go outside and let's throw, you know, parties trumping down the street, but it is to the agencies to, like you just said, hold ourselves to a new standard where we go, listen, we cannot just keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result. Okay. Because this, here's the point. I heard if we were going to do self-isolation works, Dave, when it is policed over 2 to 3 weeks, when you go, you know what? for 2 to 3 weeks, nobody leaves their house. You do that and you can make a dent into this baby. But the half approached self-isolation, really, you're just slowing down something. You're actually increasing the area under the curve, as you've so intelligently and appropriately pointed out. Okay, so that's just an overriding statement there. We do have to start thinking more innovatively, because one more piece of factoid, gotta say this, Dave. We are misinterpreting the mortality percentages of this virus.
Yes.
So please, we've got to, okay. How do you determine, okay, 5% people die from this virus? No. You get 5% because they go of the 100 people that were confirmed with the virus, meaning test confirmed, 5 died, or 2 died, or 1 died. That's your percent mortality. However, the real percent mortality is 5, not out of 100, but out of the 10,000 or 1,000 or 7,000, the real number of people that got the virus, which we actually don't know right now. What we do know is that it is way more. So the people listening, for the Canadians, for our population, for the U.S., whomever is listening, when you see that number that says in the news release, now confirmed 125,000 cases in such and such country, that's 125,000 people that got ill enough or were privileged enough to get the test. There is an exponential number above that that have the virus, that are either fully asymptomatic or passing it off as just an allergy that they had or a common flu or whatever the case might be. So we've got to get more realistic. And this is part of what's frustrating me as the hysteria cycle that we're driving. So it's all related, Dave.
There's a video I just put up on my YouTube channel, the Dave Asprey channel. It's relatively new. And it's also on my Instagram on the main page. And I call it Pandemic Math. And I actually found the data. And this is from the SARS outbreak, which is another coronavirus, right? And they initially said, oh, it's going to be somewhere around 3.5-4% fatality rate. End of the world. So 2 years later, when they actually got population-wide data, this, no one knows at first how many people have it, and there's no way to know it. So that's the real number to go with. Since they don't know it, they go with the number they know, which is a fake number. It's a very small, only people tested. So what they did is they went from 3.5-4% all the way down to 0.02%. So there's a 65 times reduction after they got the math. 65 times. And so if you say, oh my goodness, you know, up to 5% of people with COVID, which is a very high number, you know, could die based on current numbers. Well, that's because they're testing people who are already in the hospital. And they got in the hospital because they already had diabetes and heart disease and cancer and God knows what else, right? So yes, it we don't know that number, and it may be higher than we like. It may be 1%, but it probably isn't anywhere near that high, just based on the fact that the current alarmist numbers that everyone knows are bad math, that those are not 20%. If we were saying 20% of all people who got it were passing away, it'd be very different.
Of course, of course.
It's just not there. Not to say I don't want to encourage people to leave their house and all that stuff. Like, social isolating is important, and it is. It's still probably not 20%, but it's probably closer to 5 or 10% in aging populations. And if you're a high risk, like in Italy, you're over 80 and you have an average of 3 pre-existing conditions, yeah, it's highly fatal in that. Of course, so is the flu.
Absolutely. So none of this is to... none of this, certainly from my end, and I know Dave isn't saying the same, none of this is to counter the appropriate measures, but it is to say we've also got to tone down the hysteria here. We've got to be more realistic with the communities. Now, I guess what the government agencies are facing is, if they try to, how do you get people to listen to you if they don't feel that something's important, then you have to balance that against the whole disaster that is unfolding in terms of our economy. I mean, and I, you know, much smarter individuals than myself will talk about that, but I am, as just an average person, looking at what is happening here, and I'm looking from a scientific perspective and saying, per the mode of action, per the after effect, do these two things line up? And I'm starting to question if that's the case.
I don't believe they do. I'm not even questioning it. But that's all right. I'm still socially isolating for a few weeks. I don't think that doing this for as long as we might be asked to do it is going to be in anyone's long-term best interest. But time will tell.
And ultimately, Dave, someone asked me, is there a silver lining here? And I'll say, you know what the silver lining is? This has created a shockwave in our communities and our societies that we cannot lead lives that leave us just, we'll depend on acute care whenever we need it. This is going to reinforce that we've got to take better control of our health, because the comorbidities here for bad outcome of COVID are most often, not always, basal health concerns, the type of health concerns that you can address, not just by going into a walk-in clinic, but by taking ownership of your health. Taking ownership of your health will lead you on a path that, at least, we're not saying that you'll never get ill, we're not saying that you won't get COVID, but it will certainly put you way better and safer for you, your loved ones. So there's a silver lining. The silver lining is, this is going to wake up people, I think, I hope.
I believe it is. And if nothing else, we're going to look at how much we spend on healthcare and what our outcomes were in the US and go, all of those diseases that make you likely to get this are the ones that are most profitable for drug companies. So I'm not saying drug companies are evil, except the ones who buy Monsanto. You guys actually are evil, sorry. But aside from that, there's just, look, if you set up a system that's going to maximize profits, it's going to do that. And the decision that gets made automatically through hundreds of millions and billions of little decisions is one where, oh, the highest profit area of the equation is the one where people have a bunch of stuff they have to take drugs for all the time. And unfortunately, that is not what people want. It's not what's good for humanity. It's not what's good for your soul. And it's certainly not what's good for making you highly resilient and making you hard to kill, which is what we want to do.
And here's another point very quickly, Dave, and that is, if I hear anyone else, and I'm speaking again, this is from core science, the folks that, you know, the pundits that I don't know who are paid, well, I kind of think I know who they're paid by, that come out, there is no benefit in taking vitamin C. There is no evidence of the role of anything. These folks, honestly speaking, who keep promulgating this, to me, I consider them some of the vilest creatures now, because you have brainwashed a population into thinking, if it's not stamped as a pharmaceutic, it has no benefit for me. And by the way, I'm not saying that there isn't snake oil. I'm not saying that there isn't junk out there that people put into their bodies that have no good reason. There is a whole lot of it. But I am saying, if you've been so brainwashed into thinking that you get all of your nutrient from whole foods, which is where it needs to start from, absolutely, and that there's no place and no scientific study that shows the benefits of certain micronutrients, I'm sorry, Dave, this is something that we've got to correct, because there are clinical studies going out there for all of those ICUs and the hardcore medicine, and they're having to rely on NAC, they're having to rely on IVs of vitamin C, they're having to rely on things that they know work, but obviously there are pennies on the dollar compared to, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go on a rant.
No, it's people need to hear this. It's important. There was a number of hospitals, and I interviewed a doctor on Instagram, Dr. Ann Shippey from Austin, about this. And what she did is she sent a patient to the hospital, and they said, oh, our committee has decided, this is a patient who tested positive and was in distress. Our committee has decided that our treatment for COVID is, we put you on IV fluid and wait until you need a ventilator. That's all they were treating, because they weren't sure that chloroquine would do anything, even though he was already taking it. They took him off of it until his doctor intervened from outside the hospital. They didn't do vitamin C. They didn't do any of the stuff you're supposed to do. And get this, the new data that just came out, you might have seen it, just came out today as we're recording this, says that most people who go on ventilators either die or stay on the ventilator for very long periods of time. You do not want to do that. And the reason the hospital is doing that isn't because those doctors don't care. Those doctors care. They're not working these hours, not putting their lives at risk with used masks. It's because they're not allowed by their bosses to do the things that they would like to do. And that is unacceptable. Like, let's put power back in the doctor's hands.
Thank you. Dave, if I'd make a pop suggestion, there's a doctor, Dr. Dave Liepert. He's an amazing anesthesiologist out of Calgary. He's one of the few anesthesiologists, Dr. David Liepert, MD anesthesiologist. And he is the one raising the, by the way, introducing lidocaine intravenously to help dramatically reduce the cytokine storm.
Lidocaine. Oh, smart. Yeah, of course.
By the way. And so if you want to talk to someone at an MD, just brilliant level, who is not confined by the, well, I won't use colorful language, he's someone you should speak to and he can really educate your audience.
Will you introduce me? Oh, and speaking of lidocaine, I have another hack. You want to know this one? I don't think you know it, and I think it'd be useful for you and everyone else.
Go for it.
All right. So I'm so happy you said that. One of the things that I learned, and this came from Northern California Craniofacial Clinic, Dwight Jennings, who's been on the show, first 100 episodes going way back. It's a dentist who looks at substance P and systemic inflammation from bite alignment. He was in one of the chapters of Superhuman. And he taught me this, like, that's like 15 years ago. If you're just starting to get a cold, i.e. any virus, and you feel that tickle in the back of your throat, you take 5% lidocaine, you can use Solarcaine, anything like that, and you put it all over your forehead, all over your trigeminal nerve, all over both sides of your neck, your chest, and the back of your neck. Because guess what's right there? The trigeminal is very close to the vagus nerve, which innervates the entire body. And lidocaine stops inflammation of nerves. That's one of the reasons it's probably working intravenously. So you smear the topical stuff on, and magically, and this actually works, you can turn a cold around if you do it in the first maybe 2 to 4 hours. And it's just by turning down substance P and all of the stuff. And trust me, the IL-6 and all of the cytokines are way downstream from substance P, but they cannot exist without substance P. So lidocaine is a badass intervention intravenously. I never even thought of that. But just topically, you can do that when you're starting to get a virus, and it may fix it, but I've had great results with that. In fact, I have spray, like hospital grade, what they would do before sutures. I have that stuff because, hey, my wife's an ER doctor. And man, that stuff is amazing.
I'll make the introduction to you.
Mansoor, thank you for coming on from the DNA company. I am a huge fan of what you're doing. The fact that you've looked at my genes, you've sent me my report way ahead of all of this. So I actually know way more about my lung permeability and my susceptibility and all. It makes me feel like I have more control over my own biology. So thank you for that. That's just a plug for the work you're doing and for the information you're sharing about genetics in a way that I have never seen anywhere else. And thanks for your wisdom and knowledge on the show today. It's been fascinating and helpful. Thank you.
Absolutely an honor, Dave. The truth of it is I learn more every time I speak to you than you probably learn from me. So thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Your website, thednacompany.com, very easy to remember. And people can find out more about your work there. And I don't know, are you guys even doing active testing, or is the lab shut down because it's being used for other things?
Well, we've actually now switched all of our efforts into the COVID response. We're doing some cool things, Dave. We've just gotten the first rapid Class 1 Health Canada approved for an app that we're creating, Dave. Right. So, but this app is not going to be asking you just the normal questions of viral infection symptoms. It's going to be bringing in all of these, the ripple effect things that people need to be aware of. So we're very proud of it. I'll make an introduction to David Liepert, one of the brightest, forward-thinking doctors that I've met. And Dave, it's an absolute honor always.
Thank you very much, Mansoor. See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.